Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm president of the Independent Institute. I want to welcome you all to our program this evening, our program of lectures, debates, and seminars called the Independent Policy Forum. Our program this evening, as you all know, is entitled, Is White Guilt Destroying the Promise of Civil Rights? And we're very pleased to have Dr. Shelby Steele, who's author of the new book, which is already tearing up the charts, called White Guilt. And it's been out for 2 weeks, and it's already gone into a second printing. For those of you who are new to our program, hopefully each of you got a packet which has information about our books and upcoming events and media programs and so forth. The Institute itself is a scholarly public policy research organization. We have about 140 research fellows who are involved in many different kinds of studies in the public policy realm, economic, social issues, and so on. The results of this are published as books and also our journal, The Independent Review. This is the current issue, which you're all welcome to pick up a copy and subscribe to. We also produce a weekly email newsletter called The Lighthouse, which is free for anyone who wants to receive that. And I think you'll find that interesting and up to date on many current issues. Also in your packet, you'll find a program. It's sort of a yellow sheet about tonight's event. And at the bottom of the first side, I want to point out our next event, which is on June 28th, also here at our conference center in Oakland. And that particular program is called Rethinking Green, Alternatives to Environmental Bureaucracy. And we'll feature Carl Close, who's our Director of Academic Affairs and co-editor of a new book of ours called Rethinking Green, as well as Randy Simmons, who's a research fellow of ours. He's a professor of political science at Utah State and also a contributor to the book, as well as Michael Shaw, who's proprietor of the very successful 74-acre private coastal ecosystem between Santa Cruz and Monterey called Liberty Garden. In the 1960s, civil rights victories dealt a blow to racial discrimination in many ways, and yet 40 years later, many blacks remain behind, not just blacks, but other groups too. One of the questions is, has affirmative action sabotaged the gains of the civil rights movement, and what is the role of personal accountability in improving the standing of people who are considered to be members of minority groups? However, what many people often fail to remember is that only individuals exist. Only individuals perceive, think, choose, and act. We're all individuals. There's no collective. There's no collective mind. There's no collective will. They're individuals. And individuals are made up of many different things. That's what makes humanity so remarkable. But out of this, only individuals have rights, and only individuals can have claims against the harms that others might cause to them. There are no collective minds or goods, as I mentioned. And to treat people as program members of various groups who can be coercively manipulated or treated as those people by others for some mythical social good which overlooks the freely chosen goods of individuals, I believe is wrong-headed and really defies reality. Jim Crow laws and apartheid are rooted in the view that a mythical racially based collective and collective good mattered and should be enforced through the lethal force of government power, and that means to smother individual choices. Yet although Jim Crow is dead today in most respects, government policies based on race do still exist as a myth of racial collectivism, you might say, persists in a myriad of government agencies that seek to stamp us, categorize us, mold us, socialize us, and so on in different ways. So in his new book, White Guilt, subtitled How Blacks and Whites Together Destroyed the Promise of the Civil Rights Era, Shelby Steele, who is a very distinguished racial relations scholar, argues that the age of white supremacy may have given way to an age of guilt, white guilt and other kinds of guilt. And this has not been good for people who have been the victims of Jim Crow and apartheid and so on. Dr. Steele is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's written extensively in many publications, including newspapers like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. He's been a contributing editor at Harper's. He received the National Book Critics Award in 1990 for his book, The Content of Our Character. This year, he's receiving the Bradley Foundation Prize for Outstanding Achievement. He's also recipient of the National Humanities Medal. In 1991, his work on the documentary 7 Days in Bensonhurst was recognized with an Emmy, plus the Writers Guild Award and the San Francisco Film Festival Award. He's also author of the book A Dream Deferred, which was the subject of the last time we were delighted to have Shelby with us. He's also appeared on many programs. Most recently, he was on the Today Show. He's been on 60 Minutes, Nightline. This goes on. He's on the National Board of the American Academy for Liberal Education, the University Accreditation Association, and he's worked with the Manhattan Institute. He originally received his PhD in English, which is a small indication of why he's such a great writer, I guess. At the University of Utah, he's gone to Southern Illinois University and so on. And so it gives me great pleasure to introduce Shelby Steele.
Thank you for that that wraparound introduction. And it's good to be back here. I remember the last time I was here was my last book, so I guess I have to write another book to get back again. Well, that's an incentive, as it should be. My current book is White Guilt, its title, and it's attempt to sort of look at what seems to me to be a really important phenomenon, certainly in American life, if it doesn't extend beyond that, I think maybe to much of the Western world. And nobody else was writing about it, so it seemed to me that that's what a writer's looking for, is new territory. So I'll just talk about that for a little while. I don't want to give you a whole full-blown technical lecture here and put everybody to sleep. So what I'd like to do is just talk about it for a little while, then we'll open it up for questions and have a conversation. It begins, it seems to me, in a phenomenon that I think, at any rate, is one of the most important events, certainly in late 20th century history. I think even more important than the collapse of communism that happened in the 80s. And that is the collapse or the delegitimization, to use the long, awkward word, of white supremacy. It's interesting to me that this phenomenon has gone unremarked, uncommented on in many ways. But white supremacy was an enormously important force, idea, in the world for centuries and organized the entire globe and extended the nation-state system from one end of the world to the other. So its mark will never leave the world. And it gave a coherence to the world. And the important thing, I think, to understand about white supremacy is not whether or not it really is an argument for the supremacy of whites or the inferiority of other races, but what was important about it was the idea that whiteness constituted, in and of itself, moral authority. And so that if a black man in Africa met a white man on a path somewhere and there was no one around within 50 miles, the black man would have to carry the white man's bags because whiteness was authority and thus it was power. And so whites then could, given that authority, could very reasonably go around the world and take over whatever territories they desired, and to take whatever resources they desired, and to then sort of corral the people into some sort of servitude if it so suited them. Well, so you see, it was a really powerful, enormously powerful idea that gave a certain meaning to life in the world. After World War II, there began to be revolutions from one end of the globe to the other. There was a revolution in India that was passive. There were revolutions all across Africa, all across the Middle East, all across Asia. Some of these revolutions were violent. The Algerian revolution was a particularly violent one. Some of them were pacifistic. India, the American Civil Rights Revolution, was just one of many. It was one, thankfully, that was also nonviolent. Some were communist, again nationalistic. But in any case, what I think in all of them were, in one way or another, revolutions against not the idea of white supremacy. They sort of left that argument aside, but against the authority. And they succeeded. Western powers retreated everywhere in the world. Britain, France drew back from their colonies. The civil rights movement in America was victorious, so that the idea that whiteness in and of itself constituted authority was defeated, was killed off. There are no serious people today anywhere in the world who stand forth in the public square and argue for that whites ought to rule the world, that white supremacy is a valid idea. Doesn't mean that people don't believe in the idea of white supremacy, doesn't mean that all racism is gone, but the authority that was once inherent in white supremacy has been defeated. And I think it has had a profound effect on the world. Certainly it has also had a profound effect here in America. Looking specifically at America, which in many ways is where I think the dimensions of this of white guilt become maybe their clearest. In 1964, we passed a civil rights bill in the United States. In 1965, we passed the Voting Rights Act. Both of these acts, and I think they are some of the greatest social legislation ever passed anywhere in the world, ever written anywhere in the world. They're the model for other such legislation around the world. And inherent in this legislation was the acknowledgement on the part of America that it had done something very wrong, that racism was wrong, that slavery was wrong, that segregation was wrong, that white supremacy itself was wrong. I think this was America's greatest moment. Here was a nation that morally came to terms with itself, faced itself. I'm not aware of this. Maybe it has happened, but I'm not aware of it anywhere else in the world before this happening, where a society, rich and powerful, looks at itself, examines itself in the way that America did at that period in time, and makes the decision to change and acknowledges the wrong and vows to become a different kind of society. And so America has to be applauded. I'm glad to be in America because America was able to do that. It would have been very difficult if America had not been able to do that. The problem, though, as always happens in human affairs, when you acknowledge a wrong you say, yes, okay, it was wrong, and we're going to move away from that. The price you pay is that you lose your moral authority. And I think this is, again, one of the most important events in American history, that given after the Civil Rights Movement, Americans, white Americans, but more importantly than individuals, our institutions lost a considerable amount of moral authority, because now blacks and other minorities could look at them, could point the finger, and could say, well, by your own acknowledgement, you're admitting that that America did us wrong. And so the moral authority that whites lost shifted to minorities and became an important source of power for minorities. As I've said, black power is, white guilt is black power. It's the same, they are the same phenomenon. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute when I look at specifically how blacks responded to this. So white guilt then is not a guilt of conscience. It's not, I can't sleep at night because I'm so guilty about what happened to black Americans before I was born. It's not that kind of, if white guilt was that, then we wouldn't be here today talking about this phenomenon. But it is this vacuum of moral authority, this not having the authority to be able to speak about any number of issues, race, poverty, and so forth, because of having acknowledged this past, the sins of the past. White guilt is enforced by stigma. When you acknowledge that you were a part of a group, that you belong to a group that did a wrong in the past. Think, if you want to, I think, see this in vivid terms, think of the Germans after World War II. The stigma of having been a Nazi, having a Nazi in your family, an uncle who was whatever. Well, you might not, you might yourself not have been a Nazi, might never have subscribed to that point of view, but outside of Germany, all Germans, in a sense, became from then on stigmatized by the sin of Nazism, and other people could look at them and have a certain, again, moral authority in relation to them. Well, in many ways, I think that's what happened in America. Whites became stigmatized as racist. And from that point on, whites are in the position of forever having to prove the negative, that they're not a racist. Again, if they don't prove the negative, then the stigma sticks. Well, you must be a racist. And so since that time, whites, and particularly, again, our institutions, have lived under threat of stigmatization. Why is that important? It's important because if you are stigmatized as a racist in American society, if an institution, let's say, it's easier, I think, to see on an institutional level, then that institution becomes illegitimate. It loses its legitimacy. It loses its ability to really function in the society. So the stigma has a powerful impact because it has so much control over the legitimacy. How can you be a legitimate institution in a multiracial society that is supposed to be free and everyone is supposed to be equal under the law? How can you be legitimate if you don't have any blacks in your institution? So we could look at a disparity like that. Blacks could, again, moral authority having passed to us, we could look at a disparity like that and we could say, you don't have any blacks in your institution, it's a racist institution, it's illegitimate, we will sue it, we will do whatever it takes. And in a sense, since the 60s, that's pretty much what has happened is that minorities have begun to sort of manipulate that stigma. And so we call it in some circles today the race card. Play the race card. What does the race card mean? Well, if you don't do what I want you to do, then you're going to be stigmatized as a racist, and the price you'll pay is you'll lose your legitimacy. So white guilt is powerful, is a powerful, powerful force, not because people feel guilty, but because people are stigmatized and, again, have to prove the negative all the time, and for living forever under threat of being stigmatized. This leads to the next phenomenon that is a feature of white guilt, and that's dissociation. The only way to get away from the stigma of being a racist is to find some way to dissociate oneself from the stigma, from the image that you were, that you are a racist, that you are like the whites of old, that you still secretly are a white supremacist, that you still secretly believe in this, that your heart is, that you may be smiling, but your heart is still committed to racism. And so, again, whites walking around under this sort of cloud of suspicion then have to find ways to dissociate themselves from that. I think the first great example of dissociation in American life was President Johnson's Great Society. Why all of a sudden in 1965 do you just say, well, we're going to spend billions and billions of dollars, we're going to create all kinds of social programs, and we're going to dump all this money on and we're going to end poverty in our time? You create all these programs, almost all of which failed. Certainly they did not eradicate poverty. They did not bring about racial equality. They did virtually nothing. But they did dissociate the American society and the American government from the stigma of racism. The federal government had just, by its own legislation, acknowledged that it had been racist. That was too much moral authority for minorities to have. And the government really had to do something dramatic, because the sin had been so dramatic. The wrong had been so dramatic and had gone on for so long and had so clearly violated the principles of a free society that America had to do something big and huge, had to spend a lot of money to say, in effect, we're not like that anymore. We're not that old America that discriminated and oppressed people. We're a new America. And we're going to even get rid of poverty. We're going to wipe it out from the human condition. So it wasn't that the Great Society was actually going to, the purpose of the Great Society was not actually to end poverty or achieve racial equality. It was to restore some legitimacy to the American government, to the American society. I remember that time very well. I was in college in those years, and as much as I disagree with the Great Society, as terrible as it was, as wasteful as it was, as destructive as it was, I can remember feeling that I was not going to recognize my own government if it didn't do something, if it didn't make some gesture. I'd be happy to tell it what kind at this point, but it certainly didn't make the right one, and I was a part of it, not that back in those days. But it had to do something. President Johnson, there were riots from one end of America to the other. Los Angeles burned up, New York, Newark, Detroit. Huge riots, destructive riots, many deaths, much property damage. And it looked as though blacks were simply no longer going to identify with America as their nation. Militant groups began to spring up everywhere. Cultural nationalists, the Black Panthers, right up the road here in Oakland, with nonviolent passive resistance, now with guns. And ready to have shootouts with the police and so forth. So the president knew something. There had to be something used to dissociate the United States government from the past, to say we're not like that anymore. We're a different America. Well, my feeling is that almost all of the racial policy since the Great Society, since 1965, has been designed not to solve racial problems, but to dissociate our institutions and our government from its racist past, and to restore moral authority and legitimacy to the government. You see, for example, a few years ago in the affirmative action case, the Michigan case that was decided, there were 100 briefs were submitted to the Supreme Court in favor of racial preferences by every imaginable American institution, from corporations to city governments, even the military submitted a brief. You notice there was no march on Washington in favor of affirmative action by blacks, by black people, or other minorities. Nothing. But this extraordinary pressure from America's institutions arguing that the Supreme Court ought to allow racial preferences to stay in place. Well, again, why? I think the reason is because those institutions are saying, look, we are under a stigma. Our legitimacy is at stake here. We have to have a way to prove, to indicate that we're not like that anymore, that we're not an exclusive racist institution. We are an open, inclusive, that's the new word, inclusive institution that allows, that wants everybody in our midst. And so we have to have diversity policies, and we have to be able to bring in minorities so that they're here because, again, our entire legitimacy depends on it. Harvard University, Stanford University, all of the Ivy League have to have about 8% of every single freshman class be black. Has to be. Not 7, not 6, but at least 8. Probably without racial preferences, about 1 to 2% of every freshman class would be black. So the rest, the 7%, are the result of racial preferences. I've written a lot about how that the negative effects I think that has on minorities. I think one of the cruelest things a society can do is to take the best and the brightest young black Americans and basically say to them, you simply cannot compete with the best and brightest of other races. We won't allow you to do that. You can't do it. You have to depend on our paternalism. Well, what a cruel thing to do to a group that's trying to overcome 4 centuries of oppression. But does the administration at Harvard or Stanford or Yale or Princeton or any of those schools care about the impact that they're having on black students, the way they're stigmatizing them as second raters? Even that 1 or 2% who would have gotten into that institution anyway? They say, look, we have to have 8% blacks in our freshman class. We don't care about you because that our whole legitimacy, the legitimacy of our institution depends on that. If we go down to 1% or 2%, then we are going to be stigmatized as a racist university. Faculty won't want to come here. We will lose money. We will lose grants. Our institution will decline in its whole. We will lose our reputation in every way. And so, baby, we're going to have 8% blacks in this freshman class if we got to go, and no matter what we have to do to get them, because it's the dissociation from the stigma that is so necessary to the legitimacy of the institution. 1970s, the early 70s, we began to practice a welfare in America, where we basically said to people, this is coming out of the welfare rights movement and coming out of the civil rights movement, We basically said to people, okay, we'll give you a little bit better than subsistence living, and you don't have to do anything at all. Nothing. Don't have to educate yourself or your children. Don't be married. In fact, you can't be married. You can't have a whole family. And if your children grow up and they have children, then, of course, we'll put them on the dole, too. And they, too, don't have to do anything. So it's one of these odd situations where you actually put an incentive in place for human inertia. You get rewarded for being nothing, for doing nothing. Nothing. You get rewarded for, in a sense, giving up your humanity. Well, what kind of society, other than one trying to dissociate from the stigma of racism, one other acting guilty, would put in place a policy like that? Well, again, white guilt policy that is designed for that, that its purpose really is not to help the people it says it wants to help. But again gives the society itself a way to dissociate from racism and say, "Oh, we're not a racist society, and we know blacks have had it rough, and so we're going to give them welfare, and we're going to, without any strings attached. That's just how wonderful and generous we are." Well, you put that in place, and of course, it was at that precise moment in American history that the black underclass began to develop. That we began to have people, illegitimacy rates, even to this very day, the illegitimacy rate in black Americans is about 70%. In many inner city communities, the illegitimacy rate is 90%. There was a rapper a couple weeks ago who said, "Marriage is for white people." Slavery and segregation came nowhere close to injuring the black family in the way that these welfare policies, these white guilt welfare policies, injured, if not destroyed, the black family in America. It was precisely the black family that had enabled blacks to survive slavery and segregation. It was the black family that was the primary institution in black America that enabled us to survive all of that oppression. And so now in freedom, because we live in a society that acts, doesn't feel, but acts guiltily toward us all the time, and it doesn't feel it has the moral authority to ever ask anything of us, we get policies that injure us more profoundly than our oppression did. Well, let me look at the other side. There's another side to this story, and that's the black side. And, of course, I think much of this extends to other minorities, but it certainly does especially apply, I think, to blacks. When we won the civil rights movement, and we did win it, when white supremacy was defeated, we moved into freedom for the very first time in our history. And, of course, freedom had been the promised land, and we had longed to get there. You go back to the Negro spirituals and black music and folklore, and there's all this talk about the promised land and what it's going to be like when we get there and so forth. And, of course, we always equated that promised land with freedom. But freedom is very, 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 very different, fundamentally different than what we normally think of it. It's not a promised land. It isn't anything. It's just freedom. And so when we won freedom, and again, we had survived about four centuries of oppression, so we had all the skills in place to survive oppression. We were good at it. I have written in the past about the imagination, the ingenuity of black American culture in surviving oppression. We had no experience whatsoever with freedom. We'd never had it. We didn't have the values for it. We weren't prepared for it. We didn't have the ideas with which to seize it, to take advantage of it. We didn't even really know that that's what you do. That is so entirely dependent on individual will and on the assumption of responsibility and all these sorts of things were not in our experience. And so when we came into freedom, we experienced it as a humiliation. Because it's, oh my, look how inadequate we are. Look how uneducated we are. Look how non-competitive. We don't know. Well, again, all over the world, in all of these colonies that had won their freedom, the same thing happened. They ran into freedom and, woo, it was not a kiss. It was a smack. And it said, you know, you were a janitor before, and now that you're free, you're still a janitor. You don't know how to become a business executive. You don't know. You don't have in place the entire apparatus of values, of education, of opportunity to do that. You're free now, and you're still a janitor. That's painful. Freedom became and is experienced by people who newly become free as a shame, as a humiliation, as a painful experience, something that is difficult. And invariably, what happens is that because freedom is associated with such pain and shame, the first thing people do is say, hey, I'm not really free. Racism is everywhere. Oh, maybe it's underground now. Maybe it's institutional now. But boy, it's, in other words, I'm not free. Because in a sense, the group has a fear of freedom. Freedom is shame. Freedom, because if you don't know what to do with it, then, and you're not doing well in it, then again, you experience it as shame. So we began to define our situation with what is called bad faith. Bad faith is when you say, I used to say when I was young and starting as a writer, I can't really get started. I can't write this book because I don't have any time. I have to make a living. I don't have any time. So I would excuse myself from having to develop as a writer. Well, when I finally gave up bad faith, then I got... I didn't get any more time, but I worked a little harder. Bad faith is, in other words, it's excuse making. It's a way you spare yourself because if I'm free, I can do whatever I want. If I want to write a book, I can write a book. But I deny that I'm free because if I admit that I am that free, then I'm going to feel ashamed. Well, most of the identity, certainly the black identity that began to emerge right away in 1965, 66, 67, when we hit freedom, is a bad faith identity. An identity that says we're really not free. Boy, racism is everywhere. Now, we had just defeated racism. We had just stepped into much greater freedom. But we were never as obsessed with racism when we were actually segregated as we are today in freedom. Today we are upset. We worship at the church of racism. Racism is everywhere. It's just so subtle. It's in every little situation. And we're still being victimized by it. And that explains why we haven't done better. And so we are people traumatized, not by oppression, but by freedom. And the great challenge that faces us as a people, and I have every faith that we will live up to it, is to learn to thrive in freedom. We're free. It doesn't matter that there's still racism in the world. White supremacy no longer has any authority. So what if somebody believes white people are superior? I don't care. I don't care if they can't keep interrupt my life, and if they can't keep me from becoming educated and taking out loans and banks and pursuing my dreams. What do I care? I'm not going to lose any sleep over someone like that. But if I don't know how to move my life ahead in freedom, and it's, you know, I was often point to the example of my own father, who was born in 1900 and only went to the third grade. And before he went to the fields, he was a wonderful man. I wouldn't be here standing here today if it were not for him. But when I started out in the university, I couldn't go to my father and have him tell me how to get tenure. How do you play politics in this? He said, go for it. So I had to figure that out and ask people, and many people were quite willing to be helpful and so forth. But I didn't have that kind of cultural capital in my background, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's not hard to get. But if you say that your problem is racism all the time, then you won't be able to deal with the fact that you don't have that kind of cultural capital, and you need to get it. It's not hard. You just need to pay attention to it. So again, I think that freedom was this terrible trauma for us. We began to develop an identity in bad faith, and that in that, out of that trauma, what we decided, or at least what our leaders decided. As leaders are often people who smell opportunity, is they realized that white guilt was there, that whites were in this position of having to dissociate and prove all the time that they weren't racist. We developed a black leadership in America that has been since that time devoted to absolutely nothing but the manipulation of white guilt. You do not see this leadership turn around and look at their own people and say, you know, our problem is we don't have enough cultural capital. We've got to put a lot more energy in education, a lot more effort in restoring our families. Family is the most important institution in any society. Family's weak, the society's weak. We've got to really do that regardless of whether white people are guilty or not. I can accept as valid any black leader who turns around and asks most of all from his own people. But one who just simply asks of others, of whites, is the worst possible kind of leader, because then you see what position did that put blacks in? When all you're going to do is manipulate white guilt, you're stuck. Nothing is available to you but protest and anger. You have to make sure the white man knows you're angry, and you have to make sure that he's intimidated by it, and that he's a little scared of you, because if he ever feels that you're not angry and that you're not stuck in this protest mode, he won't give you anything. He won't feel the need to dissociate. So for 40 years now, we've had a leadership devoted to nothing more than that. Manipulation of white guilt. And so it is no surprise that in the year 2000, black students did worse on the SAT exam than they did in the year 1990. You know, as far as I was concerned, there was a lot of freedom in the 1990s. Why decline? Why this backward slip? Why does the illegitimacy rate stay stuck at 70%? Black women get married at half the rate of white women and divorced at twice the rate of white women. Marriage is a disappearing institution in our inner cities. Is of course weak across America in many ways, but is far, far weaker in our inner cities than anywhere else. So how has the manipulation of white guilt helped us? Not at all. It has put us right back. I think of the civil rights victories as a period in time when we talk about self-sufficiency, self-determination, where we took it on our own. There was no government program that created the civil rights movement. We got out there and got this great, wealthy, powerful society to acknowledge its wrong. We achieved that through hard work, initiative, self-determination, and so forth. And the minute we achieve it, we turn around, manipulate white guilt, and put ourselves right back in a dependent position on that society. And not only that, we nurture this dependence as a kind of black pride. So the black who is not angry about being and protesting and arguing to be dependent on the larger society, the black who is not doing that is an Uncle Tom. The black who says, I want to be self-sufficient. I want to take my life in my hands and do what, and I believe that we can get a lot farther as a people if we do that. That black is an Uncle Tom. The black who says, oh my God, we cannot make it without the paternalism of whites, without manipulating that stigma, without keeping them on the hook, as we say. That is the militant. That's Mr. Black Power. Well, so we've got it all completely screwed up and backwards. And of course, we punish those in our group who are high achievers, who have used the freedom open to them and achieved great things. Well, we say Condoleezza Rice is not really, she doesn't have the flavor. She's not really black. So we punish her. Why would we punish the those among us who do so well? We punish Condoleezza Rice because she proves that we are free and that opportunity is everywhere. She proves it. So we have to put her down because, again, we're in bad faith. We're afraid of freedom. And so we put her down and Colin Powell down, these extraordinarily accomplished individuals. And we say, again, the crack dealer on the corner is a brother. So it is when you get into this, when you make this mistake of relying on the fact that another group of people have lost their moral authority, and you say, that's my chance, that's my opportunity, all I've got to do is just keep working them, then you don't overcome, you begin to decline. The challenge, I think, for black Americans is to begin to live in good faith rather than in bad faith. Instead of constantly saying there's racism around every corner, and racism is a big barrier in my life, say instead, there may be racism, but I'm free. I have opportunities. I can do whatever I want in life. I can go as far as I want to go. And I want to make sure my kids get that message. I want to make sure. I'm not going to take my kids. Look what we do to young black kids. Oh, this is how you were oppressed. This is how you were sat upon. And in order to be black, you got to understand, racism is everywhere. They're all against you. What? How's a child going to thrive in that kind of with that kind of a message? We should say the opposite. You're free. Everything's possible. You just have to work hard. You just have to set yourself in motion. Take responsibility. And you're going to do very well. So I think blacks have to live in good faith. What do whites have to do? I think that what whites have to do is acknowledge and accept one interesting fact. It's a fact. It's not a theory. It's a fact. Since 1965 to roughly this our own time, white America, I think, has made one of the greatest moral evolutions in all of human history. There is no example that I'm aware of a society determining to correct itself morally that's been more consistent and more relentless than what white Americans have done. Today, racism is despicable. It is seen as disgraceful by whites. They want no part of it. There are certainly fringes out there, but again, those fringes have no authority, no real role in American life. And whites have done this, and whites need to accept this as fact and accept this as reality, because it is reality. In my own life, I have met 99.9% of the whites I've met have had only goodwill toward me, have helped me, have mentored me in many ways. And I have not run up against, I have certainly run up against racism. I write about it in the book. But racism has not stopped my life. I don't think it stops the lives of many people. And I think white people ought to accept and be proud of this moral advancement and put that in the calculation when you think about public policy, when you think about issues that come up, that we are, in fact, a good people. America is full of good people who mean well, not people who are rotten and evil and waiting to around every corner to stunt the lives of minorities. That just is not the reality of American life, and we whites can get out of this game of having to dissociate and fight off stigma as they begin to accept this fact, this achievement. Thank you. Let me stop there. We'll take some questions. Thank you.